Tonight, VP nominee Mike Pence will speak. Last night, he and Donald Trump got to remove the presumptive from their titles. They're now the Republican nominees. But there was a donkey in this room of elephants, most of the speakers bashing the Democrat Hillary Clinton.
Are we willing to elect someone as president who has as their role model somebody who acknowledges Lucifer? Think about that.
She repeatedly plays the gender card. In fact, she boasts, deal me in. Well, Mrs. Clinton, consider yourself dealt in. Because as a senator, you paid women less than the men in your office. And as First Lady, you viciously attacked the character of women who were sexually abused at the hands of your husband.
In China and Syria, in Iran and Russia and Cuba, and here at home for risking America's secrets to keep her own and lying to cover it all up.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, before him Sharon Day, vice chair of the GOP, and to start, former candidate Ben Carson. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here in Cleveland. And Domenico, start with Carson, because that Lucifer was a reference to activist Saul Alinsky, who apparently acknowledged Lucifer in some writing and also influenced a young Hillary Clinton. You know, the crowd loved it, but your thoughts on the Hillary demonizing?
Well, it certainly went to different kinds of levels when it comes to talking about Hillary Clinton. You know, the Saul Alinsky stuff kind of came up in the 2008 race. And it's interesting because you could read two different kinds of things into it with Hillary Clinton's thesis paper that she'd written that she'd wanted kind of kept away after the 1992 campaign. But she actually said that she disagreed with a lot of Saul Alinsky's tactics, didn't think that they were practical. So, you know, look, it's red meat for the base. This is something that has come up. Have not heard a candidate actually, you know, talk about Lucifer and Hillary Clinton in the same breath.
That's kind of new.
But, you know, but again, you know, look, yesterday was supposed to be about Make America Work Again. And instead, what you got was a lot about Hillary Clinton. And this is the animating thing that unifies this party. You know, when you talk about the disunity among Never Trumpers with Donald Trump, the thing that brings them together more than anything else is animus for Hillary Clinton.
Well, the two top Googled questions while Chris Christie spoke were, why wasn't he the VP? But then number two was, why wasn't he indicted? A reference to the bridge closing scandal in New Jersey. So there's a danger here that some of these people so viciously going after Clinton are going to remind people of problems of their own.
Well, you know, Chris Christie is somebody who Donald Trump certainly likes quite a bit. They have a similar kind of, you know, braggadocio. And, you know, he delivered a case that was kind of a searing indictment of Hillary Clinton's, you know, record. It was kind of a prosecution. He said on the campaign trail when he ran that he would try to prosecute the case against Hillary Clinton. It was a great warm-up speech, frankly. There were a lot of big stars that could have spoken last night in primetime in the Republican Party. I'm thinking of Paul Ryan, Chris Christie, and some others who did not make their way into primetime at the 10 o'clock hour. So it's an interesting way that they've decided to set up this convention, because there seem to be a lot of missed opportunities with the kinds of speakers that they've been putting in that slot.
Well, Donald Trump's children, though, the two that we heard last night were, you know, got raves, Don Trump Jr., and then Trump's youngest daughter, Tiffany. Let's listen.
He draws out the talent and drive in people so that they can achieve their full potential. That's a great quality to have in a father, and better yet, in the President of the United States.
You know, she seemed lovely, composed, well-received, but Google Trends is down the aisle from us, Domenico, and the most Googled question while she spoke was, who is her mother? You know, do all the children, as lovely as they seem to be, and as well-received, do they also remind people of Donald Trump's very public, romantic, complicated life?
And her mother is Marla Maples, who was Donald Trump's second wife, we should say. You know, I think that it is interesting. I mean, you haven't had a candidate who has had as many marriages as Donald Trump has had to be, you know, heading a major party ticket. But, you know, that's not something that's mattered to the Republican base at all. I mean, this is the majority of the delegates in this hall are very enthusiastic, enthusiastically in support of Donald Trump for the most part. So, you know, he's going to get nominated tomorrow night. We're going to hear from Mike Pence tonight. We'll see if Mike Pence can be a warm up for the primetime show tomorrow night of Donald Trump.
Well, you know, Domenico, before we let you go, very quickly, what else do you think we're going to be hearing? We got a little taste from the co-chair of the GOP. We just heard Sharon Day attacking Hillary Clinton for her attacks, as Sharon Day saw them, of the character of women sexually abused at the hands of Bill Clinton. How much more are the Republicans going to go there?
You know, we were supposed to hear a whole presentation of Bill Clinton's sexual misconduct. That was something that was promised at the outset. Mm-hmm. And it's something that you've heard some speakers talk about. Yeah, I find it fascinating because there hasn't been a lot of reaching out in this convention to potential swing voters, if they even exist anymore, or Democrats even. I think you'll hear some of that with Mike Pence tonight, who will talk about his conversion from being a Democrat to a Republican once he voted for Ronald Reagan in 1980. And I think you'll see a lot of parallels tonight that Pence tries to draw between Reagan and Donald Trump in the way that he sees it.
NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro, thanks as always.
Oh, thank you.
Happy days, although today feels like something of a sad day because Gary Marshall, the man behind iconic TV series of the 1970s, such as Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley, he died yesterday in Burbank, California. He was 81. Marshall got his start as a joke writer, but moved on to producing and directing some of the biggest hits in Hollywood on the TV and the big screen from the 1970s all the way through to these days. And NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now with more. Eric, good to have you back.
Hi.
So I was looking, reminding myself of everything that Gary Marshall touched on TV. Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Mork and Mindy, The Odd Couple. The list just goes on and on. Tell me what you loved about his work.
Well, he had this ability to sort of combine really funny comedy with really heartfelt emotional moments. And that was the one thread that I think kind of wound through all the stuff he did. You know, The Odd Couple was his first big success on television. And, you know, Neil Simon, who wrote the play, the award-winning play that it's based on, didn't want it to move to television, didn't disparaged the show at first because he didn't really watch it. And then when he was encouraged to look at it, you know, you could see it was a story about the friendship between these two unlikely guys, almost a love story between two guys who really had a close friendship despite their obvious differences. And you could see that kind of sort of heartwarming, you know, Happy Days was the story of a friendship between the Fonz and Richie Cunningham. And Laverne and Shirley was the story of a friendship between these two women who were like sisters. And, you know, you could go through Beaches and you could go through, Pretty Woman, and you could go through even Nothing in Common, which was a film that a lot of people don't necessarily recognize as his, with Tom Hanks and Jackie Gleason, a father and son who reconnected with each other. That thread runs through his work.
Yeah, you know, and you mentioning Happy Days, Henry Winkler, of course, who played the Fonz, sent out a tweet saying, "Gary Marshall, rest in peace. Thank you for my professional life." I mean, I guess we could also credit Gary Marshall with launching folks like Robin Williams into the stratosphere because he, of course, starred in Mork and Mindy.
Yeah, you know, I listened to a lot podcasts and interviews with Gary, when I heard that he had passed. And he talked about Robin Williams was a street performer who had really almost no professional credits when he got hired to play Mork from Ork on Happy Days. And Gary said that he added that character to Happy Days because his young son at the time didn't want to watch the show because there were no space people in it. And so Gary decided, you know, okay, I mean, we're going to add a space person, but they couldn't find an actor to play the part, and they stumbled on Robin Williams, and he turned out to be you know, one of the great comedic talents of our generation.
Yeah.
And, you know, Gary Marshall had a talent for finding talent and, you know, gave a lot of great actors either their first exposures or crucial exposures. In terms of, you know, Rob Lowe tweeted about how Gary Marshall hired him when he was 15. I mean, you know, this guy had an eye for talent that I think kind of got overlooked because he was so funny and so self-deprecating.
Yeah. You know, Anne Hathaway also in The Princess Diaries, another person who could probably credit Gary Marshall with helping launch her career. I mean, you mentioned some of the other movies, Beaches, Pretty Woman, A League of Their Own. I mean, really, the list goes on and on of like movies everyone has seen.
A League of Their Own was his sister,
Penny Marshall.
Penny Marshall. Right. But you know, he gave her a showcase in Laverne and Shirley, and she got to see him work. And so when she went on to direct movies, you know, there's almost a sense, you know, she was coming up under his wing, and she directed Big and A League of Their Own, I think. I think she became the first woman to break the $100 million mark in revenue for a movie.
Well, that's NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans helping us remember Gary Marshall, a man who really helped shape TV for a generation. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Back in Cleveland at the RNC, Here and Now's Alex Ashlock hit the streets last night and brought back this postcard.
About a dozen people toss green and pink tennis balls onto the street about a block from Quicken Loans Arena, where the delegates are meeting. Tennis balls are among the many items banned around and in the arena because authorities say they could be filled with explosives, even excrement. The police moved in, many of them in heavy armor, and confiscated the tennis balls.
Back up. If I take the tennis balls immediately to my car, can I have them for my dog? Please.
Chelsea Byers is with Code Pink and the Brady Campaign, who organized this protest.
Tennis balls have been banned from the RNC from 1.7 miles within the area, but we've watched people carry guns because of Ohio's open carry laws. So, yeah, we wanted to illustrate how ridiculous this was.
In nearby Public Square, a woman danced in front of a line of police guarding the massive Civil War monument there. Ronald Pittman of Bikers for Trump was also keeping watch.
I jumped on the Trump train when it fired the engine up. Build a wall, we need it. I absolutely believe that Trump will win in a landslide.
A few blocks from Public Square, a man posed for photos with members of the Wisconsin State Patrol in town to help with convention security. James Campbell lives in Dayton, Ohio. He was carrying an assault weapon, an AR-15.
I look at this more as a protest sign than anything else here in Ohio in particular. We have the right to open carry, and I think that it's important for everybody to express their constitutional rights.
So, protesters, Here and Now's Alex Ashlock met outside the arena last night. By the way, that guy needed a ride. Alex gave it to him, but asked him to please put the rifle in the trunk. Anyway, inside the Quicken Loans Arena last night, the promised message, jobs. But there was little mention of them or of wages. Republicans are against raising the minimum wage. And recently here in Ohio, the Republican Attorney General ruled that cities can't do it on their own. That pretty much shut down a move in the Cleveland City Council just last week to raise the hourly wage from about $8 an hour to $15. A big disappointment to Clevelanders like Cynthia Cruz and Juan Rivera. The couple lives in a cozy, lower-income neighborhood in Cleveland. Their Dominican and Puerto Rican neighbors spend the hot summer evenings out on the stoop. The chihuahuas and pit bulls in the yards excited to see us.
Hi, how you doing?
Hey,
hi.
Cynthia.
How are you?
Good.
Hi.
You guys can wait in the living room. I just changed the baby.
No. Hello.
Hi, baby.
It's dinner time. Juan's at the stove.
Yellow rice with, you know, Vienna sausages, beans on the side with, like, yeah.
Man, if, what is going on
if,
here?
It thickens the with potato, when you do beans, it thickens the how should I say? Yeah, the sauce.
Uh-huh.
It makes it real rich and thick.
And you're putting some chicken in here?
Yes.
Cynthia and Juan get $299 a month in food stamps. Cynthia says that's not enough and that she can't find work that would also help her pay for child care for two daughters at home, including a precious two-year-old named Sahida. Cynthia says a desperate friend asked her to take Sahida when she was born. Now she's formally adopted her.
What? Here, you can hold the microphone. Do you
want
to hold the microphone?
They're being evicted. It's a dispute with the landlord over a blocked sewer pipe. He says baby wipes were flushed. They say it's the whole block, not them.
Out of nowhere, he just told us we got 30 days to move, and, you know, without notice, you know, without reasoning, nothing. We never had an issue with him. Rent was paid on time every month.
They're fighting the eviction. It's complicated. They say they were actually renting to buy, and they suspect the landlord wants out of that agreement. But they can't afford to move, despite the fact that Juan, Zahida glued to his knee, says he works all the time.
I mean, I try to work, take any job I can, even if it's $20, $40 or whatever, because I got a family, you know, I got to provide for.
So what kinds of things?
So I do mechanic work. I put sound, you know, music into cars, body work, you know, just any type of income that I can make. I do.
And how much do you make an hour?
Hourly. I could say I could work all week. I could probably make $200, $250 maybe. Yeah.
All day, just every day.
Depends, yeah, exactly. Monday through Sunday. Yeah.
What would it mean to you to, it sounds like almost double Juan's income. What would it mean?
Oh my God, it will mean so much. Like, it will help us so much with the bills, with everything. Right now, sometimes we struggle so much to get diapers, to get milk for the baby, because the gallon of milk right now is almost $5.
I sometimes got to sell my stuff. You know, I got music, I got car parts and stuff.
And how much are you pulling in a week or a month? Let's say a month.
Our income a month is $1,400.
$1,400.
And I pay $625, light bill $115, gas bill $60, and the diapers and all that stuff, we don't have no money left. Like, I don't even drive. We walk everywhere sometimes because it's so hard. I cry. I wake up crying, and I tell him, like, this, I'm to the point I'm so frustrated, like, I don't know what else to do.
So this is not your biological child,
Juan. We had her since she was born, with a belly button and everything.
A week old, we've been with her for about a week old. She was born. And she's about to be 2 years old now.
And she's fantastic. She wants this microphone so bad. So, listeners, if you hear a kind of a poke on the microphone, that's Zahida. But right now, Zahida, also this child that you've adopted, she has a little bit of a speaking disability.
Yeah, she was born with it. Well, I did not notice at first. And then when she started pointing and pointing and pointing, I'm like, something's wrong. So I called, you know, Zahida's going to have a lot of problems. She might not even speak.
So here you have a child with special needs and are getting therapy and such. I mean, that's, you'd do anything, I can see, but
she,
that's a cost.
My heart, because my son passed away, you know, and my son got killed in a domestic violence situation with me and my previous relationship. So I think when she came to our life, it was like a lifesaver, you know.
What happened to your son?
My previous relationship just used to beat me and beat me, and I used to just stay quiet. And one day, he came, picked up a bike, and threw it at me. So
he hit your son. It hit your son.
Yeah. So he died. It's been rough. I just sometimes I tell him, like, I'm here because of her and my kids. Because sometimes, you know, you think, okay, I'm gonna commit suicide. Should I do it? Should I not do it? I had to go to the mental home for a whole year.
Meeting Cynthia and Juan reminds us that hardships have a way of piling up when you're poor. Almost doubling the hourly wage, they say that would help.
That would be like a change of life for people, especially for people like us.
Do you have any sympathy? You know the argument from the other side, that there are a lot of small business owners, and here you are, you're working with cars and repair, and it might be those small business owners who believe they can't afford to pay the $15, and then you wouldn't have any work. That's their argument.
It's like, it's crazy out here, you know, like as of me, like, I see people that I work, you know, around here at offices or just, you know, people with, like, no experience, no degrees, no diploma. I, myself, I graduated high school in 2004. I got, you know, I went to the military and the U.S. Navy. As soon as high school, I went for 2.5, you know, and right now I got my associate's degree. I went to school for aviation mechanic, airplanes. Yeah. And, you know, it's rough right now to where I got to sit down and study to get my license, but I already passed the classes.
Well, this brings us to what's happening in town. You've got a convention coming. Everybody's mind is on a lot of the issues you're talking about. Donald Trump is in town, and he says he's going to bring back jobs, bring back manufacturing, bring back jobs from overseas. Does that ring for you?
I mean, that's what everybody says. Every president that gets elected, you know, they always say, oh, we're going to put 240,000 jobs out there. I haven't seen nothing yet. Hasn't no change. Yeah, maybe a little bit here and there, but hasn't nothing been an increase in Cleveland, Ohio, as in jobs, because we wouldn't be in the situation we are now if we wasn't, you know, if everybody commit to what they're going to say.
It sounds like you need just a little bit of a break. You know, you need a break with your landlord situation. You need a break so that you can finish this education. It sounds like...
We just need a job. Poor people out here, we're struggling. We need good jobs. We need, like, you know, at least $15 an hour minimum wage. That would be great, you know. Like, pay attention to what we go through, you know. I just want them to just help us. Like, I'm just terrified of what's going to happen if, for me, my opinion, I don't want to get people mad out there, but if Donald Trump wins, I'm just terrified of what's going to happen to us. You know
why?
Because I feel like he's a man that I feel like he don't have no feelings, that he's selfish.
The view from Cynthia Cruz and Juan Rivera at home in Cleveland. And we're back now at the Quicken Loans Center. So she said she was terrified of Donald Trump. Well, he has shifted his position on the minimum wage. Last November, he said that wages are too high. But in May, he said he doesn't know how people make it on $7.25 an hour. So we will track that. And next week, when we're in Philadelphia for the Democratic confab, we'll hear the other side, a restaurant owner who says he cannot afford to raise wages.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say that they don't know how a man in Utah got the Zika virus. He didn't travel outside the U.S. or have sex with anyone who had Zika, and the mosquitoes that carry the virus don't typically live in Utah. So far, his only known contact with the virus was in caring for his elderly father who had contracted Zika while traveling outside the U.S. Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases and public health for STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication, and our weekly partner, and she joins us now. So first of all, Helen, just walk us through what some of the main theories are about how this man in Utah got Zika.
There are two sort of main theories. One is that potentially the older man, the father who was very sick and had contracted Zika while out of the country, that he might have been bitten by a mosquito and that the mosquito went on to bite his son. The CDC and the state health authorities have been trapping mosquitoes around the homes of the two men, and they're actually testing them now. But, you know, that's going to be a tough one because getting the right mosquito is kind of a bit like finding the right straw of hay in a haystack. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there may not be an answer on that front.
Right. And the reason why, if that turns out to be the case, and again, big if, why that would be significant is that, as we mentioned earlier, the type of mosquito that typically carries Zika isn't usually found in Utah. So it could potentially be another species of mosquito.
That's certainly something that they're looking at. As well, scientists in a lot of different research institutions and universities are doing a lot of tests these days on different species of mosquitoes, trying to find out which ones potentially could transmit Zika. So, yes, they'll want to see what kind of mosquitoes they found and whether or not they were infectable with Zika and whether or not once infected they seemed like they could transmit. Another line of investigation relates to the fact that the older man, the man who died, he had, the CDC said, 100,000 times more virus in his system than one would normally see. So if he had that much virus in his system, he was probably emitting it in various bodily fluids. And so they'll be asking lots of questions about, you know, did you come in contact with any of your father's bodily fluids, and trying to get a sense there of whether or not that might have been the route of transmission.
Well, Helen, while I have you, let me ask also about what happened in Florida this week, because the Florida Department of Health announced that the state may have its first case of local transmission of the Zika virus. What do we know so far about that?
Very little. The state has not said much about it, only that it's investigating and that the CDC is also helping in the investigation. They've had problems in the past there with chikungunya, which is another virus spread by the same mosquitoes. So in some respects, it's not a huge surprise. And also, Florida's had a lot of imported cases of Zika. So if you've got the mosquito and you've got people with virus in their system, it's not going to be a huge surprise that you might see some cases. What people will be looking for is kind of information about who. One would want to know if this was a pregnant woman.
Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases and public health for our partners at STAT, the National Health and Medicine publication. Helen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Last night, two of Donald Trump's children took to the stage here at the Quicken Loans Arena and the Republican National Convention. His daughter with Marla Maples, Tiffany Trump, spoke about how he used to encourage her.
My dad takes such pride in all that I've done so far, no matter how big or how small. I still keep all of my report cards, some dating back to kindergarten, because I like to look back and see the sweet notes he wrote on each and every one of them.
And his son with Ivana Trump, Donald Trump Jr., talked about his father's sense of determination.
I know that when someone tells him that something is impossible, that's what triggers him into action. When people told him it was impossible for a boy from Queens to go to Manhattan and take on developers in the big city, rather than give up, he changed the skyline of New York.
And tonight, Eric Trump will speak. Tomorrow, Ivanka, both children of Donald and Ivana Trump. The GOP hopes they'll help voters get to know another side of their father. Well, you could also read a book. Gwenda Blair is author of The Trumps, Three Generations of Builders, and a presidential candidate. She teaches at Columbia Journalism School and joins us. Hi.
Hi there.
Well, you know, it's such a great read, especially if you love New York skyline and want to know the deals behind it. But take us back to the very beginning. The family name Trumpf. The grandfather came from Germany. Donald Trump's dad, the developer Fred. Some sketchy business practices in the beginning when he's building the empire. Shell companies to get more money from the federal government during government housing projects. But Donald, what kind of a kid?
Very competitive from day one. In elementary school, when I talked to kids who went to school with him, they said he was always looking for attention and very competitive, good in sports, not really much of a student, and but very much wanted to be at the center of the attention.
Well, you know, Gwenda, it's funny. Gary Trudeau, the the cartoonist, he does this panel of Donald Trump in grade school, but he's talking the same way. You know, I got the best library card. It's the best library card. It's the biggest. It's huge. And the people you spoke with, you know, that was supposed to be kind of a joke, but the people you spoke with said he kind of was that way.
He absolutely was kind of that way. And when he went off to military school, he said himself, he told me that that's sort of when he, in a sense, hit his stride. I think he really enjoyed it. A lot of kids would be homesick, you'd think, going off to military school. Not him. He loved it. I think it was because there were so many ways, so many contests, the cleanest room, shiniest shoes, best in drills, and especially athletic stuff. And interesting, his coach told me that he was the most coachable kid he ever had because he wanted to win.
Well,
other kids... You tell them something, maybe they would pay attention, maybe they wouldn't. He paid attention.
Well, these are seen as attributes by his many supporters and his family. He was disciplined, did not drink, did not smoke. He knew what he wanted, loved to build, had a focus, watched his father religiously you know, as his son has said, he now does with his father, you know, Donald Jr. But what fascinates me is Donald Trump's brother, Fred, who was not in this mold at all, seemed like a lovely man. His friends very protective of him because, you know, the father, Fred Sr., kind of treated Fred Jr. dismissively because he wasn't like Donald, became an alcoholic, died of alcoholism. What was the impact of that? I mean, psychologists will have a field day with this should Donald Trump become president, but what was the impact of Brother Fred on Donald?
Donald himself says that that was a cautionary tale for him. His sister, the oldest child, Marianne Trump Barry, who's a federal judge, told me that Donald was going to be the one. It was pretty clear early on that he was the one who loved the competition, wanted to be a killer, what his dad told the boys they should be, and really went for it. And Freddie wasn't like that. He was funny, he was entertaining, he was gentle. He didn't have a killer instinct. And he was just sort of shunted aside.
Yeah, you got to wonder the impact of that. But let's move on. The full-page ads. Okay, so now he's becoming Donald Trump. You know, he's hanging out in nightclubs as a single man. He's making the gossip pages, building his empire. But then he's taking out the full-page ads in 1987, for instance. The full-page ads about how the country's on the wrong track. He buys into the birther movement around Barack Obama. In other words, he flirts with the left and the entertainment world that he's such a part of in New York, but then he is also a deep part of the birther movement. What's happening with him?
Well, if we counted up, the sixth time that he has talked about being president. Of course, this is the most serious one. But so he's been thinking about that since 1987. That's a long time for such an idea to be germinating. And he went up until this recently, he was a kind of liberal-ish positions, because partly, no doubt, because he was in New York City. But in 2011, when he became very involved with the birther movement, which was a very sharp pivot to the right, I think that was really the litmus test. And when he got the kind of response that he did, the very strong response where he was tapping into enormous resentment against there being an African-American in the White House, that was it. And yeah, he's tacked to the right ever since.
Yeah. To talk about, you know, while he seems to, you know, he has the television shows, he always had celebrities around him and often on his arm. Does he have friends?
Not really. The people that I talked to, and I spent over a decade doing this book, I talked to hundreds of people. Not really. He wants, as I've already said, and it's really the major theme with him, he's very competitive. The world is winners and losers. That's it. And he wants to be a winner and around winners and in the winner circle. And his idea of friends is kind of photo ops, being surrounded by celebrities, athletic champions, being in a picture, having photos of himself with them. That's friendship. He doesn't seem to have people that he hangs with.
Well, except family, very close to family, as he was to his father. Talk about the belligerent, litigious side of Donald Trump. In one instant, early on in his career, the Trump organization was sued for racial discrimination. People were people of color were trying to rent apartments they couldn't. Same people went in who were white who could rent the apartments. I mean, it was pretty clear. He said he'd sue the government for $100 million. Instead, he settled out of court, but he said he won. Sued the NFL for monopoly practices. He got the award of $1. When he loses, he says he wins. You know, a president is supposed to be somebody who can negotiate, who can bring people together. Your thoughts on his decades of fighting?
It's that competition thing. All his life, he has been trained from the get-go to look for the weakness in the opposition, find that tiny little hint of a give, and go for it. Immediately. People saw that, I believe, on the debate stage all throughout these debates, where he would just pounce on any little tiny thing that could be thought of as a weakness and throws people off balance. That's been what he's done all along and continues to do it.
From what you know, and you have, it's a really deep look at deals that were made and buildings that were built. What's your sense? Is he as successful and as wealthy as he claims to be?
There's no doubt that he has been quite successful, and we can't and shouldn't try to take that away. What's interesting about, there's so many interesting things about him, but one of them is that he has made that notion of success, of the best of the best, the best of the best of the best, into a brand. And so the name Trump, and what a gift that name is, has become kind of identified as meaning successful. So it's kind of, I think it's hard to kind of think one's way around, was he as successful as one might think he is?
It doesn't even matter because the name is in gold and it proclaims that it is. It's a terrific read. It's been a great companion on my trip here in Cleveland. Trump biographer Gwenda Blair, author of The Trumps. She also teaches at the Columbia University School of Journalism. Gwenda, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, House Speaker Paul Ryan snapped a selfie and put it on Instagram. The picture included him in front of a jam-packed room of new Capitol Hill interns. It was a lovely little celebration of future American leaders. Except, almost every single person in the room was white. And the internet responded with the hashtag #InternsSoWhite and comments such as blinded by the white. Now, it's not clear whether the Capitol Hill interns in the picture were a Republican or bipartisan group, but the picture does seem to reiterate a lack of diversity among congressional interns. And that matters to many because Washington internship programs are often the first step in the pipeline that funnels young, politically engaged people into future leadership roles. So let's get some perspective from Elroy Saylor. He's a Republican strategist and founder of Insight America, a nonprofit group that aims to increase diversity among congressional staff working for the Republican Party. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, what did you think when you saw the photo of Speaker Ryan and the Capitol Hill interns?
Well, I saw opportunity for our leader, our speaker, the conference in the United States Capitol to begin a process of continuing to grow and create new leaders and bring more leaders, young emerging leaders, to Capitol Hill.
And just to sort of put some context and numbers on how much opportunity there is, we were looking at one study about Senate staffers. So this is just on the Senate side of things. And it found that only 7% of top Senate staffers, this isn't interns, but staffers, are people of color in a nation where we have 28% of the voting age population are people of color. So there is a ton of room here for improvement in terms of diversifying not only staffers, but interns. What are the challenges there? Why aren't we seeing more diversity amongst congressional interns?
Megnick, I was an intern in 1988. I was a student at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, my junior year. I had an opportunity to intern in the Bush White House Office of the State Department Office of Legislative Affairs. Now, I didn't grow up upper income. I grew up closer to lower income, and I grew up in a city that's primarily blue-collar and primarily Democrat. While I was at Morehouse, I applied for an internship and was fortunate and blessed to come out to Washington. However, one of the challenges would have been funding or resources for transportation. Challenge two would have been housing. And challenge three would have been a stipend or just the cost of living in Washington, D.C.
Which now is higher than ever.
So most people who are low income or people of color who may not have as many opportunities as the broader community.
Right. So, I mean, just so if I can put a fine point on it, most of those congressional internships are not paid, and that's a huge problem. I mean, is there any movement to get more of those internships paid for, or is that going to be tough because, at least on the House side of things, all the internships are parsed out through the individual representatives' offices?
Yeah, I think that's going to continue to be open for discussion in terms of whether or not the United States Congress can pay for a comprehensive internship program. However, there are unique organizations, nonprofit organizations, that are doing public-private partnerships to ensure that students of color, in particular African Americans, have great opportunities to come to Washington, D.C. and intern on Capitol Hill.
You know, I'm obviously cognizant that we are having this discussion right in the middle of the Republican National Convention, and questions of race and the GOP have been paramount in this election cycle. And given that, I'm wondering, does that even further inflame the fire in your belly to do something about this? Because, I mean, I was reading an article from Carlos Mark Vera, who was a Democratic intern on Capitol Hill, and he said, hey, look, if you want to get a future job in Congress, you need to have, quote, Hill experience. And if we don't have young people of color getting that experience in college, then that future generation of leaders is just going to be as homogeneous tomorrow as it is today. And that's a problem for America. And is it a problem for the GOP?
You know, I've learned that it's a lot easier for me to speak through my faith versus through my race or the city that I grew up in, Detroit, or through the school that I went through, Morehouse College. You know, my faith teaches me that if diversity was good enough for Jesus Christ and God, then diversity should be good enough for the Republican Party and for all institutions in America, whether they're public or private. So when we look at diversity and inclusion in the culture, we need to recognize and respect and celebrate culture. However, we need to also look at the community. And until we get to a scenario where we can say that we're going to embrace community, that will allow you to bring in the various cultures, whether it's culture based on one's ethnicity, whether it's culture based on geography, whether it's culture based on gender. Those are the things that allow us to become a community. We need to create a community that celebrates the diverseness of our cultures.
Well, Elroy Saylor is CEO of J.C. Watt's Companies and a Republican strategist and founder of Insight America, a nonprofit group that aims to increase diversity among congressional staff working for the Republican Party. Elroy Saylor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. Have a wonderful day.